The newest committee in the Missouri House of Representatives is examining St. Louis's and Kansas City's earnings tax. The special interim committee, which had its first meeting a week ago, is tasked with examining both the effect the earnings tax has on the state, as well as come up with possible revenue replacement options. On this week's Politically Speaking, Representative Jim Murphy, chair of the committee, joins the show. Murphy, a St. Louis County Republican, spoke on the work the committee's done so far, his thoughts on the recent veto session, and his predictions for the 2024 legislative session. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me via Zoom in St. Louis is my co-host, St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And our guest today, joining Jason, he represents the 94th District in the Missouri House,
Representative Jim Murphy.
Well, welcome back to the show. I think you were on before I was here, so it's exciting to talk to you. We have a lot to talk about, but first, remind our listeners about your district, where it covers, and who you represent.
Well, my district basically goes from Jefferson Barracks south into Oakville. It's bordered by the Mississippi River and Tesson Ferry Road.
Jason, am I right about that? When was the representative last on the show?
So he was the first guest of 2020. And I vividly remember you coming to the show because it's one of my last memories before COVID ruined everything.
Yes.
So
let's get into it. We have a lot of topics. Let's first just talk about the veto session, which only happened not even a full week ago. What are your overall thoughts about this year's veto session?
Well, I think it was a politically active session where people brought things up that they had felt strongly about with the governor, knowing all along that the Senate was never going to take it up. So it was really an exercise of futility. I think most of us felt like we were there wasting time, wasting effort. We got to make our political speeches, so I guess that was satisfying to some members. To myself, I would have just assumed went in and went out.
You said on the floor that you voted present on a lot of those veto overrides because you correctly predicted the situation where the House overrode some things, but then nothing would happen in the Senate. What are your thoughts on kind of the differences between these two chambers on veto session?
The rules in the Senate are kind of different than they are in the House. In the House, on a budget bill, each individual could bring up an objection to the veto. In the Senate, the only one that can do it is the bill sponsor, who was Lincoln Huff, who was the budget chair over there. So he makes the decision for the entire body. I don't think that's a great system because each of those senators were elected by a majority of the people in their district, and they had no say in that. So I'm not sure I like that, but it is the rules. We knew what the rules were. We knew the individual was going to make that decision, so we knew that that was not going to happen.
What did you make of Governor Mike Parson vetoing over $500 million from this year's budget?
I had no problem with the number. Some of the individual items, specifically one here in St. Louis City for the police in the 911 system improvements, I really had a problem with that, and one of my colleagues, Lakeisha Bosley from the city, brought that to the floor, and I think much to her surprise, I stood up and told my colleagues, we should vote on this because it's right. Even though it's not going to pass, we need to send a message that we do care.
Yeah, you did speak out in favor of that motion for a new police center. I guess, what compelled you to speak out about this?
When you look at the 911 system, specifically in St. Louis City, can you think of a bigger problem that we have? And we need to fix it. You know, whether we need to regionalize it, whether we need to just put more money into that particular part of the city's budget. We need to do something. We cannot have people dying in cars that trees fall on because nobody can respond. That's just not what we do. Government is meant to serve the people. I don't think we serve the people right now.
Parsons said for some of the projects that he ended up vetoing, local money could have been used to fund them. Do you think that this is applicable for this particular project that we're talking about?
I understand his thinking, but it's a regional problem. So it's not just a matter of taking St. Louis City money and fixing it. We need to fix it as a region. But, you know, what affects the region in St. Louis affects the entire state. So, we do need to look at it as a holistic approach.
Do you think it's worthwhile for the legislature to try and include this in next year's budget, or do you think it's going to run into the same Parson veto rationale?
I never give up.
Let's move on to the Earnings Tax Committee. You are the chair of the newly created Special Committee on the Earnings Tax. How are you approaching the work of this committee?
Well, there's three things that we need to look at. One is, you know, is the earnings tax the best method of financing our cities? Two, is it regressive, and does it cause our cities to not grow at the rate it should, because businesses look at that and say, you know, do I want to go to this city or do I want to go to a surrounding area where I don't have to pay this tax? We think that the city of St. Louis is bleeding right now. We are losing businesses. We are losing population. Since 1950, we've lost 500,000 people in this city of St. Louis. Since I moved here in 92, we've lost over 110,000 people. If this rate goes on, I mean, it's just, there's not going to be a city. And as I stated at my opening at the committee, a lot of people believe that the only way you fix St. Louis is to let it hit bottom. We can never let the city of St. Louis hit bottom. We've got to save this city. We've got to save it sometimes from itself. This tax, although I understand that it's a big part of their budget, they didn't bother sending anybody in from the city who explained their budget and how this works. They have no plan that in 2026, when it comes back to the voters, if it was ever taken away from them, which the voters have the right to do, they don't even have an idea how they would replace this. You know, at some point, you need to look at all your alternatives and see if there's a better way. So this, first of all, we're going to look for, is there a better way? There may not be, but we think there are. Secondly, if there is a way, how do you finance it? You can't just pull this tax out from underneath the city and then expect them to operate. So there has to be other alternatives. And the third thing was the St. Louis City collecting remote earnings taxes. These are people that don't even work in the city, don't even live in the city, don't use any of the city services. Yet, for some reason, Gregory Daley thought it was still appropriate to collect their tax. Now, Kansas City has the same tax, and they decided that nothing had changed, the law hadn't changed, the circumstances hadn't changed. So they do allow for refunds for remote workers. And now we've gone to court. And the court case was found in favor of the plaintiffs. The city is now appealed that. But the bigger part of that appeal is the judge had said, well, this can't be a class action suit. But that's being appealed. And I'm going to tell you, as part of this appeal, if it turns into a class action suit, the city will suffer because they may have to refund all of the tax they collected, and it could be a huge sum. They should have just paid the six plaintiffs and walked away.
We're going to get into a lot of the details there, but I want to zoom out for a minute, which is just kind of, can you talk a little bit about the earnings tax itself as well as the role it plays in Kansas City and St. Louis?
Sure. In Kansas City, it's a big part of their budget. It's $350 million. So, you know, to replace that is quite a chore. It's not as big a percentage of their overall income as it is in the city of St. Louis. In St. Louis, it's in excess of 50% of the budget. In Kansas City, it's only in the 30 percentile area because they have diversified their tax base.
And it's also a geographically larger city, so that probably also helps.
Absolutely.
Diversify, but continue.
Kansas City, interestingly enough, does a lot of different things. They are looking at putting together a commission to study the tax burden of all their taxes, to look at see different ways that they may finance their city. St. Louis has said, you know, basically this is how we do things, and this is the only way to do it. Tax collector Daley came in, and he played kind of both sides of the street on this. He said, first of all I do is collect taxes. I don't make any decisions as to how they're spent or what type of taxes we get. Yet he spent his entire time talking about how harmful it would be if we took away the earnings tax. And we said, well, you know, wait a minute. What are you? Are you just the person that collects the tax, or are you the person that's promoting the tax? And he said, oh, I just collect it. Well, his entire opening statement had nothing to do with collection. It had to do with the politics of it. There are ways that we can replace this tax, and we will look into those.
You said at the beginning of the first hearing that happened last week that the goal isn't necessarily to remove the earnings tax, but why have this committee if that isn't a serious possibility?
Well, we're looking for ways to phase it out, absolutely, because we need growth in the city, and we think that this is an anti-growth tax. Part of the testimony is, well, the businesses like it and so forth. Well, actually, if you talk to them individually, they don't like it at all. They think it's just a terrible tax that they have to pay. And it's, we're finding that the way the city does it is creating so many problems for companies. For example, I have it's not a constituent, but a taxpayer came to me. They work in Jefferson City, and they had an office there, and they work for a major corporation that's out of St. Louis. Well, that major corporation decided to close their office here recently, and that she should work at home. Well, their payroll department's here in St. Louis. So even though she works in Jefferson City, that company will now have to take out St. Louis City earnings tax.
So Missouri voters in 2010 approved a measure requiring periodic votes on the earnings tax, which you alluded to earlier.
Right.
And thus far, St. Louis and Kansas City residents have overwhelmingly supported keeping the tax in place. So haven't the people most directly affected by the earnings tax been pretty unambiguous that they want to keep it?
Well, your statement was incorrect. They're not the most affected. The most affected are the people paying it. And in St. Louis City, 70% of the people that pay that tax don't live within the city, don't get to vote on that. If we allowed the people paying the tax to vote, I will guarantee you it probably wouldn't go through. And frankly, you know, that's not an unheard of idea. You know, here in St. Louis, there's a zoo tax that's paid by St. Louis County and St. Louis City. In fact, the last zoo tax that went up was for an expansion of the zoo, and the county approved it. The city didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So the county's paying for the St. Louis City Zoo. So giving them the right to vote on this would probably change dramatically the end result of it.
Now, this is more of a process question, but St. Louis County voters, who I assume are probably the majority of folks who pay the earnings tax that don't live in the city.
Right.
But they're not the only people that pay the earnings tax, as you mentioned. People who live in Jefferson County, St. Charles County, Lincoln County, and even, as you mentioned, Jefferson City pay the earnings tax too. So how functionally would surrounding or non-surrounding jurisdictions get to vote on the earnings tax?
I think we'd have to give it the right to vote if you've actually paid the tax. I think it could be done.
You mentioned that you – alternatives. Have you heard any alternatives to the earnings tax yet?
Well, we have. If our biggest problem with the earnings tax is we believe that it prevents growth in the city, we can certainly do things that over time promote growth in the city. know, if we did enterprise zones where we said if you came in and built a business here, we would exempt you from the earnings tax. If you build a new home in the city, we will exempt you from the earnings tax. If we did things that promoted growth with it, over time, you could phase down the earnings tax based on the new income that you're bringing in. So there's ideas like that that make some sense, because we need to grow this city again. We need to bring businesses here, and we need to bring population back.
You were not happy with that presentation from Gregor Afexele, the St. Louis Collector of Revenue, speaking on the importance of the earnings tax. Why did that presentation irk you so much? I could tell you were not happy.
Well, because it wasn't that I understood what he was saying, but his willingness to even consider that there were a better way. You know, there's the old saying, you can poke yourself in the eye until you go blind. And I believe that right now that's what's happening in the city. We're so entrenched in the way we do things, we're not willing to look at better ways of doing things. Everything has to be put on a partisan, looking glass. And he came in ready for battle rather than coming in ready for a working partnership. It was totally different with Kansas City. They came in and said, hey, if you can give us a better way, we need to look at that.
Can you blame them for being defensive kind of off the bat if there is a threat to some of the city's revenue? You know, there hasn't been a lot of, you know, it's the first discussion. It kind of makes sense to me at least to say, well, this is why it's important, but maybe it's more the way the presentation was and the fact that they didn't have alternatives. Is that what turned you off?
Well, no, it was that they had no idea that they would ever want to do that. You know, they basically said, if you do this, you'll kill us and you're baby killers. I mean, he came on very, very strong. And I opened up by saying, first of all, we're not trying to take this away from you. We're trying to look for alternatives. And it was as if he didn't even hear that.
Would it be fair to say that it's possible that you may recommend getting rid of the earnings tax in St. Louis, but keeping it in Kansas City? Because you can make an argument that Kansas City has grown pretty prodigiously, even though it has an earnings tax.
It hasn't grown prodigiously. I mean, it's grown in small increments. It hasn't kept up with other states and other major cities. If you look at Dallas and places like that, they're growing hand over fist. They've got their crime under control. They're doing all the right things to grow their city. We need to look at all those things to grow our cities at that rate.
The remote work situation, I can understand being pretty tricky. I mean, a lot of people worked at their homes during COVID, for example, and probably never stepped foot inside their St. Louis-based offices, but were expected to still pay the earnings tax. I'm raising my hand right now. I've definitely fallen into that category. Yeah. So how is that issue going to be explored? Because I definitely could see some people saying it is not fair to take this tax from me when I have not stepped foot across the city lines. I could again see the argument from the city that we need this revenue and, you know, too bad, so to speak.
Yeah, just because you need the, you know, it's not their money, first of all, and they have no right to it. It would be no different than if San Francisco or Dallas or somewhere else said, hey, we think that you work for a company here, so you should pay our tax. I mean, it doesn't hold water. There's no way you can look at this and say it's a fair tax. It's only fair if they're doing something to earn that money. You know, as I said earlier, you know, the government's here to serve the people, not serve the institution of government. And I'm afraid that we've gotten to the point where most of our leaders now serve the institution of government rather than serve the people. You know, fairness to the taxpayer is very important. How do you build a reputation of a very progressive, great city to come to when you're screwing over your citizenry? It just doesn't make sense.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. And we're back on Politically Speaking with our guest, State Representative Jim Murphy. Let's get back into it. We have lots of questions. Now the veto session's done, we have questions about the next session. Yeah. With 2024 being an election year, do you anticipate much of anything getting done?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people say, oh, we're not going to do anything because of that. You know, what I have said to leadership is, you know, what we tend to do is concentrate on these big deals. you know, the things that are in the headlines, you know, whether it be IP reform, whether it be, you know, tax credits or all of those things. Well, what gets lost is all the little things that we do. When you go through the bills and look at what the legislators have put forth, most of those are issues that are brought to them by their citizens, by the voters. Say, we've got a problem. We need to fix this. It seems to be a little thing that gets put aside. But if we would, as a group, whether it be Democrat, Republican caucus, Democrat, concentrate on all the little things that help our citizens, I think it would be we could have a lively debate on come the time for election, because we do things that were right for Missouri.
What do you believe Republicans or Republicans and Democrats should prioritize this upcoming session?
Well, like I said, I think it should be what the voters have asked for. You know, those things that their communities have problems with that we can fix. You know, we have to look at how do we move Missouri forward, not move my party forward or the Democratic Party forward. We need to look at all those little things. You know, crime in the neighborhoods. I had a bill on trying to stop door handle gangs coming through the neighborhoods and carrying guns. They're stealing guns from cars. We've got to put an end to that. Yet I got pushed back from both sides of the aisle on it. We really have to start concentrating on what we need to do to better our citizenry and make it safer for our citizenry. And stop the politics.
Do you think lawmakers should continue to pursue efforts to make the Constitution more difficult to amend, especially after that idea did not pass in Ohio?
Ohio's Ohio and Missouri's Missouri. I don't know that you absolutely look at both. I'm not sure that the voters are ever going to want to vote to take away their own power. Would I like to see it a little more difficult to change the Constitution? Yeah, I don't think bingo deserves to be in the Constitution. I don't think marijuana does. There's a lot of things like that probably should have been a little more. But I'd actually like to go the other way. I'd like to see what information we give the voter before they sign that petition. You know, right now we just have them sign it and say, hey, do this, and you know, have a one paragraph or one sentence explanation. You know, this will save the world. Please sign here, and we get a petition on the ballot. I'd like to see that we require a little more information go to the to the voter rather than, you know, change the number that they need to vote on.
So that would be kind of an approach you would look at versus upping the voter thresholds or maybe changing signature requirements or requiring a majority of Missouri's congressional districts. What would your petition look like if you were to write it yourself?
Well, if it was up to me, I'd have information handed to everybody that's about to sign the petition with both the pros and the cons of what, you know, what this would do. Maybe it's a synopsis, you know, that comes from the public comments that are given to the Secretary of State, something like that, so that people don't just sign. You know, certainly if you look at the marijuana law that just passed, it had a lot of problems in it, but it was written pretty much by the industry that, you know, it was for them. But it wasn't explained that way. It was like, oh, you know, this will make pot free to everybody. You know, it was great.
I don't think anyone was saying it was going to make pot free.
No.
I think people were like, I just want to go to a dispensary and buy marijuana and not get arrested for it.
Right.
Which is what is happening in Missouri right now. We did two shows on the pros and cons of that. So yeah. I understand the argument that it's a sweetheart deal for the existing medical marijuana license holders.
Right.
It did not seem that voters cared about that.
They wanted
marijuana.
Absolutely. And I don't have a problem with that, frankly. I think it could have been done better. I think we should have demanded better.
On the last day of session, House Speaker Dean Plockert said it was important to pass a measure to raise the constitutional threshold in order to scuttle initiatives that could legalize abortion in the state. I think you were probably at that press conference.
No,
you weren't.
I was not.
you were doing something more important, I suppose. Do you agree with the speaker that those two issues are linked?
Probably they have some effect on each other. I'm not sure that depending on what comes on the ballot. If there's a crazy ballot initiative that has abortion to the time of birth, I don't think it would pass in Missouri at any rate. I don't know. The voters are going to decide these issues, and they should. Like I said, I don't think that changing the Constitution is the way to go about it with a simple majority, because we don't have a simple majority of all of the residents of Missouri. We have just a simple majority of the voters, which don't often line up with the entire state.
Yeah, not to go down too much of a rabbit hole, although this is a show where we jump in rabbit holes all the time.
Sure.
But there are multiple proposals on abortion that have been put forward. Some are actually fairly quote-unquote modest, that put in exceptions for rape, incest, mm-hmm. a broader health exemption, 12 weeks possibly. And then there's more expansive ones that perhaps go up to Roe versus Wade standards, which is like 22, 24 weeks. Do you think that the people that want to raise the constitutional threshold lack the confidence that they could rally a campaign to defeat either one of those initiatives? Because on its face, it doesn't really seem like they're super confident that they could defeat either of those archetypal ideas at the polls.
I believe that it might be difficult on a reasonable exception, but I don't believe it's going to be very difficult to the extreme ones. I don't think that I think basically we are a pro-life state. We are a Christian state that does not believe in abortion on demand. I mean, we still believe that babies have rights too, and I think it looks like in the media that it's a big swing to, you know, let's legalize abortion. But I don't believe that in the hearts of Missourians, as I talk to them, that it's as overwhelming as they'd like to believe.
One area where there was not a lot of movement this year was in education policy. Mm-hmm. There's been some chatter about Republicans maybe wanting to expand education savings accounts or charter schools. What are your expectations about what education-related bills could be considered next year?
I think all of the above. I think they're all very difficult to pass. Within the, you know, we have a supermajority when it comes to maybe guns and life, but after that, when you see the Republican caucus, we're very split on a lot of things. There are an awful lot of superintendents and former school teachers and principals that are now members of the Republican caucus who are protective of the institution. We have one group that's more protective of the children, one that's protective of the institutions, and they do it at all costs. So it's very difficult to make big changes in education. We know that some changes need to be made, and even the ones that should be easy aren't. The open enrollment bill, you know, was demonized, but it's a very good bill. I'll give you an example. I have a granddaughter who has been taking cello lessons over at SEIU since she was 4 years old, and she's a fantastic celloist, and she's just going to high school. Her high school has a very, very weak orchestra, and they don't do any competitions and so forth. Yet school district right next to Lindbergh has a great orchestra program, and they do compete. So she will be denied the opportunity probably for scholarships because she's in the wrong school district. Yet she has no right to go over to one that would actually serve her better. It's not that hard.
Unless they move to the school district.
Unless you move to the school district.
Do you think another one of the splits on education is between what rural Republican legislators want in terms of education policy and what suburban lawmakers may push for?
Well, I mean, we always have to understand that, you know, the rural life and the urban life are two totally different worlds. You know, we face this when we talk about youth carrying guns, you know, and when you go out in the country, you know, they're driving around with their pickup truck with a rifle in it, and they're, you know, going out and shooting rabbits. That is not the case in St. Louis City. But if you ban guns, then now you've affected their lifestyle, and it hurts us. You know, it would help us. So to find that, to thread that needle where you're looking at urban versus rural, they are two different worlds, and we have to approach them differently.
You serve on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. What mm-hmm. issues do you anticipate coming up next year?
Well, you know, a lot of these things that happened in the budget will probably be revisited. You know, 44 still is an issue. A lot of the rural roads are still an issue. Those things will all be revisited, I'm sure.
You know, one of your bills that you filed and have gotten through the House is legislation requiring political subdivisions that require the installation of electric vehicle charging stations at certain businesses to pay the costs associated with that installation, maintenance, and operation. Yep. Why file this bill?
I'll give you a good example. In St. Louis, South St. Louis County, where the SAMS is and the St. Louis County Southern offices are, there's a movie theater there that's like a Keller 8 that's been now vacant for like 10 years, and it's actually getting to be an eyesore. They've got plywood up on the windows. I got a phone call the other day from a pastor of a church who wants to buy that piece of property. They want to turn that eyesore of a movie theater into a church. And he said he went to the county, and they said, oh, that's great. You got to put in 10% electric charging stations in that big old parking lot. So he said, well, we can't do that. We can't afford the $1 million it's going to cost us to do that. You know, can you do something about it? And that's the case. You know, it's an overkill bill. It was not well thought out. We're asking businesses to pay tremendous sums for what is a political reason. You know, building codes are meant for health and safety. There's nothing health or safety related to making them put in an electric charging station. Now, I'm all for it. Tesla will put them in free. And so should GM, and so should Ford, and so should all of these other people. Our businesses shouldn't be paying that for the auto industry.
One other question before we move into politics, because we're recording this on Monday, September 18th, 2023, and the city of St. Louis is about to announce that they're going to be restarting their red light camera program. Now, this issue actually was quite the topic of conversation in the legislature in like the early 2010s, but kind of tapered off, especially after I think red light cameras were declared unconstitutional if they were set up in a certain way. Do you think that this issue may reemerge in your committee if the city goes forward and restarts them?
Well, Jim Lemke isn't around anymore. So.
Well, he's kind of around. He's like running a bunch of candidates, including a gubernatorial candidate, but continue.
Yeah, I imagine we'll see something on it. There is some constitutional questions about it, and it depends on how they do it. I think it was found unconstitutional because it tied a driver to a car without any identification that the driver actually was the one that was driving it. If they have some way of actually showing, you know, proving that you were the driver, I don't know if there's a constitutional reason to fight it. We'll have committee hearings on it and see how it goes.
So let's move on to elections. Right now, every statewide office that's up for grabs features a Republican primary. And we could talk about, for example, the titillating treasurer primary that has three candidates. But I really want to talk about the governor's race between Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe, Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, State Senator Bill Eigel. How do you think this race is going to shake out? And do you see it becoming super, super negative and hurting the Republican chances in November?
You know, it's interesting. I know all of the individuals, and I consider most of them my friends. There's differences in the way they go about governing. I think Jay Ashcroft is certainly more conservative than Mike Kehoe, and Bill Eigel is certainly, you know, at least portrays himself as being the most conservative person in the world. But I don't know. You know, sometimes I think that the Eigel campaign can do one of two things. It's going to either blow up or it's going to take off. I at this point, it's a long way to that election. Mike Kehoe is, I think, outworking everybody and outraising everybody. but you just can't discount the Ashcroft name.
Yeah, I kind of see it. I have like three different thoughts about this since there's three candidates. Number one, Ashcroft wins because his name recognition is just too overwhelming to overcome. So that's one.
Yep.
Number two, Mike Kehoe wins because he's gotten the most endorsements and people really like him personally. And he does have, look, I know this is going to sound hard to believe for people that are not older millennials like myself that went to the University of Missouri-Columbia, but Mike Kehoe does have a lot of name recognition among people my age because of his car commercials.
Yep.
And as far as Igel goes, yeah, I definitely understand there's not a lot of like Republican legislators who are standing up for him just because he's made so many people mad. But I went to his kickoff. There were like 500 or 600 people there.
Yeah.
It's hard to like go to an event and say this guy doesn't have any support when he drew a crowd of hundreds of people.
Well, I agree with that. And that's the thing you don't know how to judge, actually. But if you remember Paul Kurtman when he ran for
auditor,
he used to have events and he'd get thousands of people and you think, oh my God, this guy's going to win. And he ended up coming in fourth.
That's true.
So you don't know whether that crowd translates into huge, widespread support.
Are you supporting anybody in the governor's race
at this point?
I'm staying
so far out of this. It's unbelievable.
What do you think the general election will bring? I mean, right now, Crystal Quaid is the only Democratic candidate. Do you think this race could be closer than 2020? Or do you think that state is just too Republican for a Democrat to win right now?
Well, I don't think Crystal has quite the name wreck that the previous Democratic candidate had. So I don't even think she'll perform as well, to be honest with you.
That's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Representative Murphy, for joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And Representative Murphy, thanks again for being on the show. Where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
You can find me on Facebook or Twitter. It's JM Murphy 8.
All right. Until next time, so long.